America.
Wake up, America!
Wake up, America. It's time for Michael Dean After Dark. I'm your host, Michael Dean, Freedom Fiend, and this eight-night feisty Liberty Show. We have a rotating stable of interesting insomniac co-hosts. Plus, we leave the phone lines open. So if the hamster in your brain is keeping you up, please call in. This is Michael Dean on the Freedom Fiends Talk Radio Musical Extravaganza. And on the other end of the line, I am the Iron Hamster. I am the unchallenged owner of that title, and no one's taken it away from me yet. In the other corner, we have Randy England, also known as the Wampus Cat. Hello, Randy.
Hello. I thought I was the Iron Hamster.
No, you're the Wampus Cat. You told me you're the Wampus Cat. Aren't you?
I am. I was just putting you on. That's exactly correct.
What's a wampus? I know what a wampus is, but maybe all the listeners don't know.
A wampus cat. Well, I'm not sure if they're real. When I was young, I was afraid of them. The story may be apocryphal. Who knows? But when I was in the Boy Scouts, they said that there was this thing that had a body like a bobcat, I think, but bigger and kind of shaggier and lots more horrible. Even maybe it had a face like a man or something, you know?
Okay. I'm reading it's from Cherokee mythology, and it's basically a fearsome variation of a cougar.
Yeah, but there were some key things about it. I mean, not only did it, you know, prowl at night and eat Boy Scouts and that, but the main thing that it did is it walks and ran backwards. I mean, this was dead serious. And, you know, the reason I thought that having a man's face was probably made up part was because nobody's ever seen a wampus cat's face because you don't live to tell about it. They walk backwards.
Yeah.
And the proof of this was that it was explained to me that we always set up our tents on an east-west axis for some reason. And I was explained to me that the wampus cat always hunted on a north-south axis. And the whole point was to keep a wampus cat from backing into your tent when you were camping out. It made sense, and that part seemed like it had to be true.
Wow. Yeah, what region did you grow up in? Was it Missouri?
This was, well, next to Missouri. It was in Alton, Illinois.
Okay, because they're supposedly they still haunt the forest of East Tennessee.
I wouldn't doubt it.
But, you know, myths like that folklore like that spreads through the oral tradition from state to state and person to person. Yeah, and, you know, it seems like every region has some mythical monster. I know that where my wife lived in Texas when she was younger, there was... She awake? What was that thing in the woods, in the swamps? The Gungus monster, which was kind of like a Sasquatch of the Texas swamps. And it attacked people. So, yeah, a wampus, and then a wampus is, there's a thing called a wampus in written tradition. It's a shapeshifter from a French comic book from 1969.
And well, this would have been ahead of that.
Yeah, that probably inspired this. But it was sent by an evil cosmic intelligence to destroy Earth. That's not you. You're just the one that walked backwards. And, you know, some variations of the wampus cat myth say that it can turn into a person and back into a cat. So it is a werecat. And I've been using werecat as my middle name, Michael Werecat Dean, because I got tired of my middle name, Michael Wareham Dean. It's a family name.
Okay, well, you can have that because I won't change into anything else. Just a wampus cat.
All right, so let's talk about the Pirate Bay. And the co-founder, and anyone who doesn't know, who's listening, who doesn't know, Randy is an attorney, and he used to be the bad kind of attorney, the prosecutor type of attorney, and then he saw the light and gave it up for private practice to protect people from that kind of.
You always get this out, what? Don't you, Michael?
I always get this what?
You always get this out. You always get this out there that I used to be a villain.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Well, I think it's. I think it's important to your story, and I'll probably say it for the next 20 times you're on and then just put it on the website. Because eventually, you know, I'm going to have everybody write a bio for the website now that we have 10 co-hosts. And I haven't done it because I wanted to wait and see who'd stick around, but it seems like everyone's sticking around. So we'll have you write one at some point. But yeah, I think it's important to say, or at least to say that you're an attorney, if we're going to be talking about legal matters, because otherwise you're just another nut on the internet saying, well, what the law says, and most of them are wrong, and you're probably right, or if you're wrong, you're wrong for all the right reasons.
And there are no nut attorneys, so that's safe.
There are no nut attorneys, yes. They're all wonderful, including Obama. Obama's an attorney.
I guess unless he let his license lapse, I'm not sure.
Well, you know, in a few years he'll probably get called into World War Crimes Court in The Hague, and after that I think your license gets taken away when you're in prison for war crimes.
Will they take away your Nobel Prize?
Yeah, and they'll melt it into a lump of shame and put it in your prison cell with you. I think that Obama became a constitutional attorney to know better how to undermine the Constitution. What do you think of that?
Takes one to know one. I think that's as good as anything.
Takes one to know one makes it sound like I'm a constitutional attorney undermining the Constitution.
You know, I avoid that as much as possible.
Undermining the Constitution?
No, not undermining having to think about it. If the Constitution, in the way that the Supreme Court has distorted it and interpreted it, you know, through the years, it gets to a point where you just feel that it becomes ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, like what amounts to commerce under the Commerce Clause and things like that. I mean, it's almost embarrassing to discuss with a layperson.
Yeah. Well, I'm a layperson, so let's talk about the Pirate Bay co-founder being arrested in Sweden and going to be serving, how he's going to be serving copyright violation sentence. This is from Reuters, and first of all, there's a picture that kind of caught our eye, and you were wondering which one is the Pirate Bay guy in it. So it's there's two kind of, you know, 30-something hipster guys in jeans and T-shirts, and then in front of them, there's a 60-something gray-haired man in a business suit. And you're like, oh, is he one of the founders of the Pirate Bay? And without even looking at the caption, I'm like, no, Randy, that's their attorney. And yeah, that's their attorney. So, you know, you want the gray-haired square guy with a lot of experience. You don't want the hipster lawyer with the power ponytail. What'd you say about old guys that act hip like me? No, old guys that act hip, old attorneys who act hip. What'd you say about them?
You mean just old guys that try to act hip? You were asking me if I was hip. I said if I did that, I would just look like an old fool. So
No. You're not hip, but you're cool because you're not hip. This is the Freedom Fiends is where the hip meet the hip replacement. That's our demographic.
Oh, man, that's rough. But it's getting truer. I know you hit the big 5-0 a week ago.
Yeah, I know. And almost got killed by lightning the same day. So, let's see. One of the founders of the file-sharing website, Pirate Bay, has been arrested in southern Sweden, and he's to serve an outstanding sentence for copyright violations after being on the run for nearly 2 years. Peter Sund has been wanted by Interpol. You know, actually, I've emailed with this guy, and he's written back, which is... I wonder what lists the people I've communicated with get me on. I guess we'll find out when I go fly somewhere for the first time in 7 years. But
I keep hoping, you know, the news in the last week was that supposedly Snowden's has a list of the people that the NSA is spying on.
I want to see that and see if I'm on it.
Yeah, I'm going to say I will be disappointed. I would like to be on it. And I'm probably not.
What have you done to get on it? I'm kidding.
That's what I mean.
Not enough yet? You'd hope to be on it?
You know, it would be an honor.
Yeah, it would. I mean, you know, I know vaguely a couple people that are on the Southern Poverty Law Center's hit list. Not their racist hit list, but they're like, you know, people who are horrible because they support the Constitution hit list. And, you know, Richard Mack is on it. He's in my movie. We interviewed him. I think I've talked with the guy from the 10th Amendment Center. But I'm not on there. And I keep thinking, you know, I got to be on there. I hope I'm going to be on there someday. Maybe I'll be on there someday. You're nobody till you're on there someday. But, let's see. Kat Bleach, whatever her name is. Kat Bleach, who's going to be at Porkfest showing some movies. Same night I'm showing some movies. She's on there. I haven't met
her. She's
just
she's a libertarian, isn't she?
Yeah. Yeah. If you're a libertarian and you have more than 1,000 Twitter followers, I think they put you on there. So I'm late.
You can kind of get on there just from being anti-war.
Yeah.
Simply because if you're anti-war, then maybe they'll think that you're anti-Semitic or something.
Yeah, because you don't want to be Israel's right arm.
Yeah, yeah. And
join the U.S. Army and fight for Israel. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I hate to say that because I don't have anything against Israel, but...
Oh, we said, well, I have nothing against Jewish people. I have a lot against Israel because it's a state. You know, I have something against all governments, all states.
Well, that of course. I meant, in particular, I mean, they're like any other state, of course.
They're like any other state, except more than any other state, they drive the military policy of the United States.
Yeah, well, see, that'll get you on the
list. Saying things like that, yeah. But, you know, I'm kind of thinking that... that list is old, and getting on the Southern Poverty Law list isn't even going to be cool anymore. I really think the hip thing is going to be is to be on Snowden, the list that they release of who's being spied on.
You're absolutely right. You know, back when I was a prosecutor, the Southern Poverty Law Center had a big influence on prosecutors' office. Every prosecutor's office in this country received regular mailings from the Southern Poverty Law Center. I never heard of them before I was a prosecutor. And they were explaining, you know, who the terrorists were and who to go after. And, you know, our police department here in Jefferson City, they had a big poster up from the Southern Poverty Law Center explaining what to look for, you know, with domestic terrorists. And these are hate groups. And I'm reading the list, and there's people on the list that I thought were fine.
People or people, things that people do?
No, they were people on the list.
Like, yeah, Ron Paul is on that list.
Yeah, well, that would fit.
Well, we'll be back with more on what's wrong with the world and how we'd fix it on the Freedom Fiends after this trip to the market. You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
This is the Central Scrutinizer. I steal your labor by force through taxation.
My job is to spy on you and keep you from hearing things like the Freedom Fiends. I especially do not want you to
torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to keep them drone-proof. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives.
Michael Dean, and it's After Dark, and it's the Freedom Fiends, regardless of what the audio branding says. It'll get changed, I promise. I thought it was going to happen tonight. Radio moves at the speed of the 1920s, man. It's so not the internet, but I'm grateful to be on, and I like it, but it's just, you know, giant machinery and, like, literally gears that turn, and... yeah, it's not like doing things on the internet, which is why it will go away one day. Although I think talk radio is going to go away anyway, because I think the next president is going to say, we can't have this anymore. We need every radio station to be broadcasting local news about how the police need more money to protect you from yourselves. What do you think, Randy?
I think that if that ever happens, somebody's going to have to say, we'll just do it anyway.
Radio?
An unjust law is no law at all.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I
dig it.
I dig it. Who said that?
St. Augustine, 1,500 years ago.
Cool. So we're talking, speaking of which, but they'll still throw you in jail, and we're speaking about the Pirate Bay. And I was talking about how cool it is, the heroes that kids get to have now, people like the Pirate Bay and Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning and Bradley Manning, Chelsea and or Bradley Manning, and Glenn Greenwald. Am I forgetting any of them? There's millions of them out there. But yeah, it's a lot different. Like, who were the heroes when you were growing up, Randy? Who did kids have to look up to?
Well, there were the Beatles, of course. But they were national world stage. My favorite personalities from the late 60s.
The Lone Ranger.
were, well, no, that was even old then. But
John Wayne?
My DJ was Johnny Rabbit on KXOK in St. Louis and Harry Carey broadcasting for the Cardinals.
Wow.
And Johnny left St. Louis, Harry left, and I left. And it's never been the same there.
What do you mean you're DJ? You worked there at a radio station?
Well, no, I was a kid.
Oh, and listening, listen.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have one of those little transistor radios?
You bet I did. It was fantastic. Everything that was important came in over that.
How much did it cost and who made it?
I think that I got it for a Christmas present.
Yeah.
So I don't remember.
Do you remember the brand name?
Oh, sure. I think it was a Sears. Maybe Craftsman. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm a few years younger than you, but my family had four kids and lived on hand-me-downs, and the only radio in the house when I was growing up was a tube radio.
Sure.
Yeah, tubes.
Had them back then. Yeah, I think Sears brand was Silvertone.
Silvertone made nice guitars, actually, that are kind of coveted.
They did,
by, like, millionaire guitar players. Like, Jimmy Page played a Silvertone on some songs.
My first electric guitar was a Silvertone.
Do you play electric guitar, Randy?
I don't have one anymore. I sold it and got an acoustic.
Are you good?
No, I'm not good. I play chords and sing with it. And if I was good, I wouldn't have gone to law school.
That's funny. I know an attorney who's a pretty good guitar player. But yeah, there was a band in San Francisco that was a Western swing band that was all attorneys. It was their hobby. They were great. Had a pedal steel player.
Yeah. You know, although maybe you get impressed when, you know, if a bunch of doctors or lawyers or something play and they say, and you go, they're decent. And it's not that they're that great, but it's just that it was so surprising that they could do anything else. You know, yeah. I don't know. And you were talking about national heroes, I guess, and Pirate Bay and people like them and what? Edward Snowden and Julian Assange and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that if we didn't have people like that that are always pushing at the edges, we'd be going downhill faster than we are.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned the Beatles. John Lennon was kind of a punk in that way. He returned his knighthood medal or his member of the British Order. It's sort of like a knighthood. The Beatles were all given one. And he returned it. He sent it back to the Queen in protest of the Vietnam War. Do you know that?
I do remember that.
He was also on Nixon's enemies list. There's, you know, I think there's a good bet for the possibility that the government murdered him. They just waited until he was kind of a has-been to the point where it wouldn't make him a martyr.
Yeah.
I think those old spooks have long memories.
Well, they didn't have to. If they didn't, it happened anyway.
Yep.
You were destined to be listening to this show, Michael Dean After Dark, on this very night. Thank you for arriving.
Since time began, tyrants have taken aim at personal liberties. Now there's a movie that aims back.
The government has no more right to tell us what to put in our bodies than they have to take our guns or tell us what books we can read.
Six drug police were eaten by bears while raiding a marijuana farm.
On your knees, you dirty hippies! Jesus. On your knees!
What's the problem, officer?
Today, many cops who enforce pot laws do so only because it provides them with cushy jobs, good benefits, and a chance to push people around.
I was an undercover narcotics officer. The drug war is nothing but a farce.
The Second Amendment says you gotta keep you and your gat intact.
Guns and Weed, the road to freedom. A film by Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadavi.
DVD available now at gunsandweed.com or on Amazon. That's gunsandweed.com. Makes the perfect gift. Remember, that's gunsandweed.com.
This is Michael Dean, the Iron Hamster, on the Freedom Fiends Talk Radio Musical Extravaganza. And on the other end, we got Randy England, the Iron Wumpus Cat. No, the Wumpus Cat. Randy asked me why I introduce both of us every segment. It's because people listen to radio in their car, and sometimes they just listen for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes on the way from the VFW hall to the church potluck. So I want them to know who and what they're listening to in case they really like it and want to find it later. After radio is destroyed by the next president and there's none left, and they have to resort to getting fiends torrents via carrier pigeon, which is a service we're going to start offering. So, Randy, you wanted to talk about cops suing to not be accountable. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was a story this last week about the Seattle police filing a federal lawsuit about the use of force policy that their police department is now forcing them to comply with after a Justice Department investigation came out and said that they were being much too mean to their citizens. And by mean, excuse me.
Yeah.
I had a cough there a moment.
Yeah. Good use of the mute button. Thank you.
Well, I can be taught eventually. But there was, I think just about everybody remembers, or maybe not, but 3 or 4 years ago, there was Seattle, of course, you can YouTube Seattle police brutality anytime you want and read through the 7 or 8 pages of videos of people being mistreated. But there was one 3 or 4 years ago, this 50-year-old man who was crossing the street. I think he may have been drunk, and he was carving. He was a street carver, and he was carving on a piece of board and had a knife in his hand and was carving on it. And the police car pulled right up, and the guy walked on by, and the cop jumps out of the car, and he's screaming after the guy, and the guy walks out of the frame. You can't see it. And then the cop walks up, and he's all, just as he's about out of the frame, the cop yells, "Drop the knife, drop the knife, drop the knife," 3 times. And of course, this guy is a ways past him by this time and isn't even paying any attention to him. And within about 4 seconds, 5 seconds tops from when the cop started screaming, you hear the 5 shots go off. He murdered him right on the spot. And it was just the most shocking thing I think I've ever seen.
Wow.
A police officer do. And that was in Seattle, and you can see a million things like that. Well, that and other events caused a Justice Department investigation, and they came out with a new use of force policy in the Seattle Police Department. And now there's a lawsuit filed this last Wednesday from it's a whole bunch of police officers in Seattle, apparently, and they're suing Eric Holder because his Justice Department was behind this investigation. But also suing the police department and suing the city of Seattle and, well, everybody and his brother, the chief of police, everybody that had anything to do with this new policy there, because they're upset about the new use of force policy. And I looked at the petition, and here's the thing that they seem to be keying in on, because the policy says that deadly force may only be used in circumstances where the threat of death or serious physical injury to the officer or others is imminent.
Yeah, and they don't do that anymore. They shoot first and ask questions later. You know, maybe they've always done that, and they're just there's more citizen-generated media now, so there's more people sharing it. I'm not really sure.
Well, they're supposed to obey this, and not only does the danger have to be imminent, the suspect must be acting in a manner or threatening to cause death or serious physical injury to the officer, and he in fact has some means, you know, like a gun or a knife,
yeah,
and the opportunity and the ability to do so. So if somebody is a drunk laying in the gutter and has a knife and the cop is standing up 10 feet away, that's not going to cut it for shooting him.
Yeah, and now it seems more like the marching orders that are followed are, you know, if they don't comply, if they don't obey, you know, you pepper spray them or tase them and then kill them if that doesn't work. You know, the pepper spray is kind of like the slave master's whip, you know, it's the way of getting you into line.
Well, there's also the taser, and they talk about that in this thing. there are some things, some horrendous things that the police are starting to do as a result of this policy that I think are supposed to upset us and the public and the courts so they can win their lawsuit. Like, the one thing the police are really angry about is that now there has to be a review of their conduct anytime a suspect complains that he was hurt by the cop. That apparently is very upsetting to them. And if the suspect claims that they hurt him, apparently before this, nobody was supposed to pay any attention.
So the cops just think everyone's going to do that all the time now, and they're going to be constantly under review if they don't get this challenged?
I suppose. I think they think that they've always done that, and they liked it when nobody would ever investigate. It says that lots of cops are turning in their tasers now because they're apparently not supposed to use them without certain cause.
They'll just shoot you now.
Here's another good one. Here's another thing that's supposed to really scare the citizens of Seattle. They claim there's been a decrease in proactive policing, which translates to going out and hassling people. Apparently, they had a lot of problem with stopping people when there wasn't really any cause to do it. Let's just, you know.
Yeah.
Driving while black, driving while punk, having funny hair color. I don't know.
I think part of what's going on is that they used to routinely hassle people and, you know, violate their rights routinely. But I think it used to be mainly minorities and poor people, poor white trash, poor white punk rockers, poor white whatever, and any minorities. And I think that it's part of the redistribution system that now, you know, they'll do it to everybody.
Apparently, people are not as afraid of them as they used to be. I mean, you can imagine if a guy can be shot 5 times and killed 4 seconds after he's given a warning when he's walking away from you, that if a cop yells at you, you're going to stop pretty quick. And they're complaining now with this new policy that there's a bold new disregard for police authority in the streets there.
Well, you know, Mama Liberty once said, if they don't want civil disturbance, they should stop disturbing us. And they do. I mean, think about most police work, or a lot of police work, is not protect and serve. And it's not, you know, I watch these cop shows on TV because that's, And it's my guilty pleasure, and people have criticized me for it, but it's like, I like good drama, good writing, good acting, good directing, good, you know, creative camera work, et cetera, blah, all the things that make good filmmaking. And I, unfortunately, on TV, a lot of the best examples of that these days are in cop shows. But I tend to like the cop shows like CSI more than cop shows like Law and Order or The Shield. You know, The Shield is horrible. They're constantly roughing people up. Law and Order, they're always roughing people up, but they're always like, you know, child murder rapists who, you know, like, you know, they'll be beating them up in custody and trying to get the location of the kid out of them, you know, something that's imminent danger. And the partner will say, hey, there's cameras in here. You're going to violate his rights, you know, as if they would stop in that situation, or even if he ran a red light and they didn't like him. But, you know, CSI, like, basically, they're not even really cops. They're scientists, and they're just solving murders. You know, they're not out beating people up. So I kind of like that, but it's kind of false too. And you know about it's false because that's, you know, and whenever there's cops in that show, you know, unless they're the bad cop being weeded out and thrown in jail, which does happen. And they do that on TV because they want to show, yeah, once in a while, you know, they get policed, but they usually don't in reality. And, you know, when there's cops on that show, they're usually accompanying the scientists to go rescue some hostage somewhere. They're doing something good that anybody would want someone to do if it was their family. Whereas most of what cops do isn't that. It's writing tickets. It's hassling people. It's bugging them. It's kicking in their doors. It's throwing bombs into babies' cribs. You know, and I will believe there are good cops when the good cops start arresting the bad cops. That's what I think.
Yep. You know what the chief complaint really is, though, and the legal thing that they're hanging their petition on, is they're saying that the new policy violates their constitutional right to self-defense. You know, and which, you know, it's kind of interesting because
I don't think the Constitution applies to cops, which is like something that would make saying that would make most cops want to shoot you. But think about it. It's like they already have extrajudicial rights. They can often shoot you and get away with it and just get a paid vacation for a couple weeks. They investigate their own, which is like sending the rats to guard the cheese.
Well, you know, that's true. And compared to other people, they have constitutional rights to protect themselves out the wazoo. Because look, there's people that work in emergency rooms, hospitals, teachers in schools. They're not even allowed to carry a weapon, let alone defend themselves.
And the police are issued weapons, all sorts of weapons, you know, and they say like police issue, that's the term. You know, they're given a gun, a taser, a nightstick, and mace. I mean, that's four weapons to begin with right there. They're handed to be cops. They're given a radio where they can call other cops to come help beat you up or hide evidence or whatever they want to do. They have body armor, which is illegal for citizens to own in some states. You know, they have cameras everywhere. They can film you. You can't film them somewhere. So take it for a minute. Take it for a minute. I got to let a cat in. Go, Randy, go.
Oh, well, let the cat in there. No, I would. The thing is, if you had a teacher somewhere who was in a state where it was a crime for him to possess a firearm, and then a school shooter came in and started shooting people, and he took the shooter out and saved a bunch of lives, I mean, what could they do but charge him with a crime? So this teacher certainly does not have the right to defend themselves. So I don't know why a police officer, as part of his job, would have any extra constitutional rights to defend himself within the parameters of what his job gives him a right to do, I think.
Yeah.
But are you back there, Michael, yet?
I'm back. Yeah, the cat's in.
How is that cat? It wasn't walking backwards, was it?
No. I mean, it seems like a weird thing to, like, step away during a radio show to let a cat in. But my wife's asleep. The cat was outside. The cat knocks on the door. It's kind of weird and creepy. But the cat, like, puts his front feet up on the screen door outside the main door and, like, pushes on it. It sounds like a drunk person banging on the door. Like, I still love you, baby. Let me in. Like, the first time I heard it, I grabbed a gun. You know, first time in this house. Because we didn't have a screen door in the old house. So we'll be back with more about what's wrong with the world and how to police the police when we get back.
I'm glad you didn't do anything rash.
Nah, I'm sensible with guns, unlike many cops.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, the invigorating alternative to those other late night shows.
Except me. NSA is watching me all the time. You know, it used to be paranoid to say, the government is recording all my phone calls and reading all my emails. But it's true. It's true of all of us now. They don't actively have someone listening to everything. They're putting it all into a giant storage facility in Utah. So when they get either when they get enough computing power or so when 98% of the public works for the government, they'll have people to go through all of it. But pretty soon the list is going to come out of the people they actively have someone in a corner office or a, you know, cubicle somewhere listening to. And I think the Freedom Fiends or some of us are going to be on that. So we got another police article about Seattle, Seattle and elsewhere. This is from NPR.org. Randy, you want to read some of this? As more police wear cameras, policy questions arise.
Well, you know, I just pulled that article up, and what I'm guessing here that the police department doesn't like it or does like it.
They don't like it.
Which is it?
Most cops don't like it. And actually, in Seattle, they were suing to not have to wear them. The police union there sued on their behalf. I think that's still pending. Here's my thought. An honest cop would want a camera because he wouldn't have anything to hide. You know, they love saying that to us, but they're public servants, supposedly. Here's the thing. Like, throw all this stuff out the window. What we really need is private police organizations and no public police organizations, because the way things work now, everyone is robbed at gunpoint by taxation to pay for police, and the police have no incentive to do well or to even catch criminals or to not hurt, you know, not to hurt citizens. And yeah, I said citizens, and I know that a true ANCAP is supposed to not say citizens, but most of the people that are policed consider themselves citizens, so I'm going to use that term, at least in the way the police use it. So an honest cop should want to have a camera because, you know, someone that he encounters could do something dishonest. And, you know, I mean, I've heard of people, of suspects, you know, this is rare, and I don't even like to bring it up because it sounds like apologist for the cops. But, you know, I've seen footage of a guy in the back of a police car who was drunk and didn't know he was being filmed, who was banging his head and then later said the cops beat him. You know, that you need a camera there for, because if you're an honest cop and he's a dishonest perp, you know, who knows what he's being arrested for or if he should be. But, you know, you want a camera there to see, to show your side of the story. I would think cops would want it, but most don't.
It helps them a lot. I've had plenty of DWI cases where, you know, I got the video from the police car, and I've got my fingers crossed, see what's going to happen. And then my client can barely sit up in the seat, and I'm going, that's about it for this guy. You know, I was just looking at while you were talking there, and I was listening, but an officer that is in here saying the only thing that really was different about doing business with a camera on them is that I'd tell the person that we're being recorded. That probably helps police officers. Some people who would get out of line and crazy would behave themselves more if they knew they were being recorded. So I could think that that could help the police.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see a world where anybody doing policing has a camera on them and is armed, and everyone they're talking to and trying to police has a camera on them and is armed. You know, two guys with cameras pointed at each other with guns on their hips. That makes for an honest society.
It really does. We had a state representative here in Missouri who was mad about people being recording police encounters with people, didn't like the fact that people would do that, but he thought that cameras should never be used to make the police accountable, but only in situations where it could protect the police.
Well, it's kind of interesting because now they're like New Hampshire recently declared, it was a case involving Carla, the president of Free State Project, that it was legal in that district, you know, four states and Puerto Rico to film the police as long as you don't interfere. But I thought, we'll talk about this when we come back a little bit more, about the Supreme Court case a bunch of years ago where basically they said it was legal. Michael Dean After
Dark. Go to michaelwdean.com. That's michaelwdean.com.
Good evening, my fellow
worms. I know some things I don't know.
I'll be back with more later on.
I'm never satisfied.
This is Michael Dean After
Dark. Stato sperimentato.
The United States government presents
no vision can grasp.
Not having enough money.
The power was so great.
Estos por su parte consideran
to provide guidance to mankind.
Go to michaelwdean.com for more. That's michaelwdean.com. We'll be back for hour two after this trip to the market on Michael Dean After Dark.
Bye for now.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Hour two of the Freedom Fiends. And if you don't love America, get out and move to a ship in international waters. That's what they say. They say if you don't love the fact that you were born here, an indentured servant to the state, to the corporation that is the state, then you should get out. But you can't really get out anywhere because there's states everywhere. There's always a government. And I want to go to another planet, but that's not an option yet. And I think that when it is an option, they will be co-opted by the state. They love to spend billions of dollars to put a flag on some dry rock in space and say it's theirs. And then, you know, probably send their space army to get you if you go there. And try to say, leave me alone. But some people have tried seasteading. Tell me about seasteading, Randy.
Well, they call that now, I think the term is a startup nation. And, you know, it's the thing that people have been doing for thousands and thousands of years, and that's finding a way to escape from the state.
Well, that's why, you know, that's why people, they say that's why the pilgrims came here, but there's actually a whole other alternate truth to that. They committed mutiny to come here and then enslaved the people with them. But yeah, you know, a lot of people have moved from one nation to another to escape religious persecution or political persecution or ethnic cleansing or all sorts of things. The history of humanity is littered with horrible people who have power over other people. And the interesting thing is, for most of history, it was done at the point of the sword or the point of the gun. It was done with you know, you don't have a choice. You have to live here. You were born into this. This king was appointed by God, or this pope was appointed by God, and they're going to tell you what to do. And the interesting thing is now they've kind of soft-sold that to where the people, you know, democracy gives the belief, the mistaken belief, that the people authorize that. And they do kind of in a way, because not by voting for one aspect of it or another, but by co-signing it, by agreeing that it's the best system, even though it's flawed. You know, there's that cartoon of the Aztecs or Toltecs throwing a virgin into a volcano, and one guy's saying to the other, well, it's a flawed system, but it's the best one we've got. And that's I don't buy that, man. I don't buy that you have to go with the flawed system. And I may be just wasting my breath and shouting into the darkness 7 days a week for the rest of my life, but I'm going to do that. I'm going to say, this is wrong. The way people are doing it is wrong. Because, you know, slavery, before slavery had to end, and it really had nothing to do with the state, with Lincoln. He was just getting in front of the parade. And for slavery to end, people had to come out and say, slavery's bad. And that's how it started, you know, and people got killed for saying slavery's bad. But you don't get to the point of enough people hating slavery to get rid of it until the few of them stand up and say, slavery's bad. And a lot of people are saying the government's bad now, but most of them want to replace it with some other government. But I just think the idea of government is bad, and you think that too, pretty much, don't you, Randy?
You know, you said that, you know, for all of history, you know, we've had states and that, and it's
not
really
true. It's not true.
Well, it is true for all of history,
of written history, yeah.
Only states write history. Yeah. But for most of mankind's existence, there was no state. There was never a state before agriculture. That's what really made it all possible.
Yeah, because things were in one place and they were taxable. But, you know, that's another thing that's different now, too, because of the internet and because of electronics and computers and microphones and things like that. History is not only written by the victors and by states, because we're writing history with our mouths right now that's going to be around in 100 or 200 or 300 years. It's going to have far more of a chance of being around, especially if you go to the Freedom Fiends and click on the Torrent Club link and help out. This is going to have far more of a chance of being around in 200 years than like something that two people wrote down on paper 200 years ago.
I was reading a book by a fellow named James Scott. The name of the book was The Art of Not Being Governed.
Yeah, I've heard that's a good one.
Yeah, and it was subtitled something about upland Southeast Asia. But it's an area that they scholars have called Zomia. And it's Zomia is really the higher altitude places in Southeast Asia. And you could think other places similar would be, say, Appalachia in North America would be a place where people have gone and kind of separated themselves from the civilized society for a time. But the theory of this book, and it was pretty well done, I go with what the guy said, it was, have you ever heard of a people called the Hmong people?
Yeah.
In Southeast Asia? Well, there are some of these, what they call hill people. And if you go into lowland anywhere in Southeast Asia, whether it's Vietnam or Thailand, and they talk about the hill people, and it's the people who live up in the hills, in the mountains, at higher altitudes, that are far enough away that the government really can't get to them or hasn't been able to in the past. And these, when it, the first two big societies were almost 5,000 years ago, were the Chinese and the Indian subcontinent, were the big civilizations that started up. And from the time they started, people started running from them. I mean, the societies, human society, civilization, has the big first characteristic of all early civilization is human slavery. They're going to make you be slaves. Then there is taxation. Then there is temporary slavery, like they call it corvée labor, where they just conscript you to do a job, and then you can go back to raise crops for them until they want to steal that and have another job for you. But all, and oh, conscription to fight their wars for them. And a lot of people don't like that, and they worked real hard to get away from it. And there are still people in the world that are still have escaped that, but there are fewer and fewer every single day. And the people that live in the up in the hills in Vietnam and out southwest China and north of India and everything in between there, I mean, there's a big area. I don't know if it's a million square miles, but it's a bunch. And there are millions of people in this area. And these people have, over time, this fellow Scott talked about, they developed these state, what they called state repelling features. You know, I mean, first the things they would do, they were real mobile. People who are down in the valleys, they're in rice paddies, raising rice. It's a crop that the state knows is going to go in. It's easy to get to. It's in a lowland area.
It's easy to wipe out with Agent Orange.
Yeah, but it grows at a certain time. The tax man doesn't have to show up in the planting season. He doesn't have to show up in the off season. He knows when the harvest is, and he can show up. It's real easy to tax. And so they love that. But the people in the hills are really mobile. You can bet they don't grow, you know, the rice. They're growing things. There's hunter-gatherers, of course, but there's agriculture, too. You know the term slash-and-burn agriculture?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you hear that in a negative way, like these people are really responsible. That's just government's word for what's called swidening agriculture, where you clear an area, grow some crops on it, and then move on to another area. Well, states don't like that, and the Chinese states didn't like that, and the Indian states didn't like that, because they couldn't find these crops. And to be even worse, these people would do other things in their crops. They picked crops that couldn't get stolen from them, because either the states would come looking for the crops to steal, or they would go to war with each other and run through your town, your territory, your village on the way and steal everything you have. Like if you had cattle, you've lost it. If you have grain, you've lost it. So they're planting things like potatoes, roots, cassava, things like that, that are underground and in patches here and there. And it's almost impossible. And if the army is coming through your village, you just run higher up into the hills until the army comes through. They're not going to find your potatoes. Come back down, your food's still there. It's a great way to avoid the state just messing everything up. So, you know, those are things that, you know, they would do. They hate to have people ordering them around. States want the hill people to have chiefs. But there are certain people in the hills and that if a chief gets too big, they kill him. You know, no chief is allowed to get too big for their britches, or they're going to be gone. Or if they're not if they're a more peaceful type, they'll just run higher up in the hills. But they're going to avoid the state.
And that sounds barbaric to most people, but how much more barbaric is it having, you know, untouchable leaders that can do whatever they want and get worse and worse and worse?
Well, that's right. And, you know, when we say somebody gets too big for their britches, it means they're starting to act like the state.
Yeah.
And when you don't want to have a state, you're either going to get the heck out of there or you're going to put this guy down. And it wasn't like this would happen to you without you knowing. They're in a society where they don't allow that. Other things that they don't have much of up in the hills, they don't have a lot of writing. And many of them see writing as a state institution. Because
well, you know, the first youth mathematics was basically invented for taxation, for counting.
For the census and taxes. Sure.
Yeah. And, you know, written language followed not much after that by the state.
Yeah. And, you know, it presents a problem for us now. Two things have happened in the past few thousand years. Back when these people were going off to hide in the hills, there were a lot of hills that they could go hide in. Where can we go now? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll talk more about that tonight. It's a really good question, and I just wanted to interject a little bit about the writing thing. And I kind of think of writing as square, which is weird, and it sounds anti-intellectual. And I'm not anti-intellectual. I probably am an intellectual, and I am very good at writing. And I've written 500,000 published words that were published by people other than me. And I've written, 10 books. I've written one book that sold $1.5 million retail worth of copies. But I don't like writing anymore. Basically, the only time I do a lot of writing now is in the service of doing spoken word, radio and podcasting. You know, I do a lot of emails. I do a lot of writing ad copy. I do a lot of things like that. And it's all toward talking because I really feel like one person speaking to another is the most powerful form of human communication. That's a sentence I say in the ad for Creamy Radio Audio, and I think it really sums up why I'm so into doing six shows a week of talk radio and trying to preserve it forever with torrenting and getting people to help with that. I feel like writing is square, and maybe that'll be the name of this episode. Writing is so square. We'll be back on the Freedom Fiends.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, and yes, we're broadcasting this message into space.
Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean, available on Amazon.
Your house is your property.
Freedom Fiends, Michael Dean, Randy England, the Iron Wumpus Cat. No, the Silver Wumpus Cat. We don't know what kind of Wumpus Cat he is yet. We'll take your calls. No, we won't. We don't want calls. So, we're talking about a whole bunch of things. I think the name of the show is going to be, this episode is going to be Writing is So Square. Just kind of because of that little rant in praise of the value of one person speaking to another, of spoken audio, of recorded spoken audio, of the oral tradition, no pun intended, and the value of hearing words in someone's voice. And doing it live 6 nights a week, man, it's hard. It's really hard, but I'm really digging it. It's what I wanted to do my whole life. And every time I get on here, I'm really happy to do it. But sometimes I'm like, ugh, tonight? But, not in a bad way. Just in like a, it's weird for me to have a commitment every day, the same place, the same time. I'm not used to that. And I've structured my life in such a way as to not have to do that. But one thing I like is movies. And there's a movie that has some Hmong characters in it. And it's called Gran Torino. And it's by Clint Eastwood. He directed it and stars in it. And it's great. It's kind of like Dirty Harry with an M1 Garand. That's my short term for it. But it's more complicated than that, and it's pretty good. The Hmong in it, one of them's a gangster, and there are Hmong gangs in America. But, it's a family trying to get by, trying to do the best with what they can. And isn't that what stories are about, Randy?
Yes. What I think I was about to say when we left was that things have changed from the old days when people like the Hmong and others – could run, hide out, and adopt strategies. Although we could adopt strategies, they had certain strategies like agriculture and hunter-gatherer and things like that to avoid the states. And we've got a couple things that are not going for us now. And one of them is that there's nowhere left to run. Seasteading is, well, come on.
If you get too big at seasteading, they will send, you're going to need your own Navy.
That's not going to work.
Maybe
another
you.
Planet would work better.
It's the psychosis of government, of the state worldwide, that they can't let anybody be, to the point where if you're floating in the middle of the ocean and have your own closed economy, they want a part of it.
They do. And one other problem, not only do we not have anywhere to go, but I think, at least I don't want to lose all of civilization to get there. I mean, I could probably run out now and hide far enough back in the woods that nobody would find me.
For a while.
But that's not the life that I would look for. So we have to find a way through, even though there's nowhere to run and we're not about to give up our comforts. Even though you might be willing to give up writing. You probably talk more in a month than you wrote in your whole life, right?
Yeah. And that is the thing, too. It's like it takes me, we do a show. It's a 2-hour show. You take the ads out. It's 1 hour and 20 minutes. We do about probably 10 minutes of prep on it. I do a lot of work during the week, calling stations and maintaining the website and paying bills and talking to, advertisers and all sorts of things. So I do a lot of work in it. But generally, once that's all done, to do a show, to do, 1 hour and 20 minutes of quality, really good sounding, spontaneous, interesting, hopefully. No, it is. Put it this way. A few thousand people think so on the internet, and, probably 20 or 30,000 people listening on radio think so. So people like it. People listen to it. It changes people's life. People write me all the time and say it was their path to liberty. And to make 1 hour and 20 minutes of audio takes me about 3 hours. 10, 20 minutes of prep ahead of time. We get on 10 minutes ahead of time or a little bit, and we email back and forth during the week. I have to do some editing when we're done, take out the long pauses, put my ads in, then do some normalization, my secret Michael Dean tricks that make it sound better than all the other, better and louder and clearer than all the other audio stuff out there. And, then to upload it and tag it and give it a title and all that. It takes about 3 hours to make, 1 hour and 15 minutes of music. So it's about a 50% ratio. Whereas to make a movie that length takes me a year. And, to write a book that would take, where the audio book would be, that would take me a couple months. So yeah, I like it a lot better. It's a lot more spontaneous. It's a lot more natural. And, you think about the writers that you like that died before you were born. Most of them, you've never heard them speak. And really, a lot of personality comes through in people's voice. And we're going to go to the break. We're going to go sell things on this weird medium of radio where we speak and then we sell. The old speak and sell.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark. And I'm speaking directly to you. Yes, you.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've been on the World Wide Web since its inception in 1994. I've tried dozens of web providers in that time. The only one that hasn't broken my heart is HostGator. HostGator has unlimited server space, unlimited throughput, and a guaranteed uptime of better than 99.9% for only $150 a year. You can pay a little less elsewhere, but you'll pull out your hair dealing with anyone else. HostGator has great service and unlimited tech support, only a phone call away, 24/7, 365. HostGator is where pros like the Fiends host, because we know how to do it right. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the HostGator affiliate link on the right sidebar to sign up today.
As Freedom Fiends, and I guess the topic is how spoken language is cooler than written language. I loved books as a kid. I lived in the library. I'm pretty much self-taught. My mother taught me how to read at five. And after that, there's very little I learned in school that helped me. I was bored out of my skull because I was smarter than my teachers. The other kids picked on me because I could read in kindergarten. Like, oh, you think you're so smart. You can read. And, you know, it kind of followed me throughout school. And then I went to college and basically flunked out because I cut class so I could go to the library and actually learn something. And so I've always liked reading, and I wanted to be a writer from a really young age. But I guess as I got older, and basically after I became a published author and wrote 10 books that are published, you know, like six of them by mainstream publishers that pay me royalties and advances and all that, I kind of got disillusioned with it. You know, everyone wants to be a writer, but once you're a writer and you deal with deadlines, and I'm really good at beating deadlines, but you know, once you deal with editors and people who kind of want to take your craziness out of it and make it more palatable to the masses, it kind of makes you not want to do it. And that's why I'm hiding out in talk radio. What about you? Do you write a lot? You've written a book.
I don't write a lot. I've written a few books, but I find it to be hard work. it is hard work, and if you care about making it right. You can sweat over it, and finally, you get tired of it, and then you do something with it. Although I quit, I had a publisher way back in 1989 on the first one, and the problem with that is that I'd like to have that book back, but I can't. It's gone because they have the copyright, and I've got nothing. And I did a self-publish back in 99, which I own the rights to. And I was really glad because about a year ago, I put it out back on the internet in an e-version. And so that's kind of nice. And the latest book that I did is self-published too. And of course, you don't have to deal with editors.
What's the book? What's the book that the publisher owns? What's that called?
Oh, the one that the publisher owns is called Unicorn in the Sanctuary. And it wouldn't be of interest to a whole lot of people because, as you know, I'm a Catholic, and it had to do with some issues within the Catholic Church. And so it was a limited audience in that way. And, it's sold good.
Here it is. I'm looking at it right here on Amazon.
Yeah, I think they sold about 30,000 of them, which I guess was respectable. But the book is gone. Obviously, it's so old, I don't sell a bunch of them now. You get a check a couple times a year and go out and buy an ice cream cone.
Do you do a lot of writing as an attorney?
I don't write so much unless I have an appeal or something like that. Doing criminal law, most of the time you go and talk to your client, then you go and talk to the prosecutor, then you go and talk to the judge, and that's my job. But there's not a lot of writing unless you have an appeal or some big motion that you have to handle. But there isn't as much of that as you might think.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yep. I like writing. You know, when I was a kid, I kind of like idolized authors. You know, they were my heroes. And I had this really unrealistic view of authors. I thought they were all fabulously wealthy and lived in castles in Europe and, smoked opium and had pet panthers and, were surrounded by many beautiful women. Then I met some writers, then I became one, and then I decided I didn't want to do it anymore.
I think that's Stephen Koons. Is he the fellow that writes all the military, naval, naval books?
Sounds right.
He had a blog, for aspiring writers, and I can remember reading it on that, and he pointed out that there was the tiniest percentage of writers, professional writers, other than journalists, taking them out of the equation, the tiniest percentage of writers, I don't know if it was 1% or it was something like that. There are fewer people that are able to make their entire living from their writing than there are members of Congress.
I don't think that's true. I think that might be true of fiction writers, but there's a lot of people.
I think that's what he was referring to.
Yeah, because I made a living for 5 years as a writer writing nonfiction how-to books, and I make about a third of my living now from royalties on those same books.
I think he was talking about fiction.
Yeah, yeah. I had an English teacher that told me that there are less than 50 people in America who make a living writing poetry. But I think that's probably a lowball. If you're talking about pure poetry, but you know, there's people who write greeting cards and things like that, and that's poetry, and they get paid. But an ad copy is kind of poetry a lot of times. And rock music, you know, lyrics can be poetic, a form of poetry. Although words that work as lyrics really, really well as lyrics often don't stand on their own as poetry. You know, there's the rare exception, people like Bob Dylan and some others. And yeah, there's some contemporary ones too, but poetry and lyrics are different things. They're related.
But if you're a musician and you write a poem, don't you just want to set it to music?
Probably, yeah. And, you know, there's some writers, some novelists who wrote poetry too. Like Bukowski wrote poetry. I didn't really like Bukowski's poetry. I loved his novels. But
I don't know Bukowski. Maybe I need to.
Really? Wow, you are square. That's cool.
Yeah,
that's a good
thing.
I don't
know what happened there.
I don't know anybody who doesn't know Bukowski. He was he's kind of the great American writer, or one of them. He's considered that. He was he wrote a lot about drinking and being drunk with different women and being in jail drunk and being unemployed drunk and working drunk. And I think there's a theme here, but you know, they made a movie of one of his books, a Hollywood movie. It's called Barfly. Mickey Rourke plays him basically. Not
so
ringing
it wasn't,
a bell.
It wasn't, no, not at all. we went over this earlier that yeah. I conceded that I was very square. Being libertarian is about as far as I get, I suppose.
Oh, I think it's pretty hip. I think it's
and
pretty
my,
hip.
My kids would just make fun of me if I tried to do any more, too. they can be pretty hard on their old man.
How old
especially
are your kids?
My daughter is 36, and she's the oldest. Then I got two boys, and then my youngest boy is 29 or will be. No, yeah, he just turned 29. So, yeah, they're getting up there. Yeah. They're getting up there. I mean, I got a grandkid, too, which he's, you know, he's a genius. But, you know, we're still waiting for his first book to come out.
For his first words.
Well, he's only six months old, so give it yep. some time.
Yep. So, yeah. I want to talk a little bit more about writing versus speaking. Let's go talk a little about the history of writing and speaking. You know, spoken language probably goes back at least 10,000 years. Written language goes back to probably Egypt around 3500 BC, which there was a full-fledged state existing in Egypt then.
Yeah, I wonder how far the written language goes back. Because we were talking earlier that that is something that the state probably could not exist without. I mean, how would they find you if they didn't write it down?
Yeah, I mean, and math, complex mathematics didn't happen until around 3000 BC with the Babylonians and the Egyptians for taxation. So
you know what?
There was math.
You know what the first writing was?
What?
The first writing.
Oh yeah, it was a tax document.
No, your first writing was a tattoo to put on your slave.
That's how
think about how easy it would be just to run off. They did that. So they could catch you anytime for the rest of your life. And
yeah,
bring
I mean,
you
that's, you know, a lot of people don't understand why black slaves were popular with slave owners in America. There were white slaves, there were Irish slaves, there were Irish indentured servants. There were also white slaves. There were Indian, American Indian, you know, native slaves. There were all kinds of slaves. But black slaves, if all the black people are slaves, you can spot one when they run away. You don't have to look for a tattoo or papers or anything like that. That's why they were popular.
That makes sense. That makes sense. But the people in, say, Southeast Asia, China, and that, those people,
they
probably
enslaved their own.
They looked a lot. Well, their own and their neighbors, of course.
Neighbors.
You know, you always, your neighbors.
But neighbors like that.
Being a good neighbor means going and enslaving them. Well, the British were still dragging people onto their ships just a short while back, right? What do they call that when the Navy grabs you and?
Yeah,
I guess
hits you over the head.
There's a word for it, but I just call it the draft.
The draft.
Well, yeah. It is the draft. Yeah. I was relieved when I dodged that back in 1971. I don't know.
Yeah, you were. They ended the draft while you were still very young and eligible for it, right?
Well, they ended the draft several years later.
They never really ended the draft because you still have to sign up for it, which means they could call you.
Oh, yes. And it's a crime if you don't sign up and give them your name, because they want to know where they can find you when they decide to reinstitute the draft. And only a country that imagines starting a war that would be so unpopular that they had to force people in to fight at gunpoint would have to do such a thing. So that says a lot about us.
Yeah.
And the only reason why there is a draft is because the old people, me and you, and that are too cheap and we're thieves. And so you have some young kid.
Hey, he's 18, 19. Don't let me in with those thieving people.
Well,
I'm old, but I'm not a thief.
I know, but the only reason that we have a draft is because people don't want to pay the market price for a mercenary.
Yeah. You know, I have a really good, quick story here about convincing people of things by using the utilitarian argument rather than the moral argument. I saw my neighbor the other day in his backyard with a .22 rifle, which is illegal in town. I don't care, though. You know, he's an old guy. He's probably 70. And I went back there. I'm like, hey, what you doing? And he's like, well, I got this little garden back here, and there's rabbits eating it. And I like the bunnies. I'm not against hunting. I love guns. I don't really want this guy shooting .22s in town next to my house, though. It's pretty close. You know, I could hit his house with a baseball, with a stone. Not that I'd
throw
stones.
Bunnies can look a little like cats, too.
You know, I could spit into his yard. It's that close. But, I told him to get coyote pee to sprinkle in his garden, because I said you could shoot bunnies all day long and they'll still eat your garden. There's thousands of them. And he said, okay, put the gun away.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum. You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing. Buttons. Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
Hey, there's some Squisklar Squig Elves from Death Clocks, and you are listening to the Freedoms Fiends on the... You know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now, so there you go.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
It's Michael Dean, Freedom Fiends, with Randy England. And this is the redemption in the third act, the denouement. I can't speak French. So before we get into Randy talking about smuggling marijuana into Wyoming, not that he's planning on it, but the fact that people do it and other people are upset about it, I wanted to ask you, did you tell me you lost a Bitcoin at one point?
I lost a BitNickel once.
Because you forgot your password, right?
Yeah, but I lost the whole wallet thing. I don't know what it was. I got it for free, though. This is back in the old days when a BitNickel was only worth like 5 cents.
I love the term and, bit. It sounds like an old timer thing, like he's not worth a BitNickel.
Well, it was 0.05, so I assume that you call that a BitNickel. But
you coined that term.
I probably
did. That's a great term. I've never heard it.
I didn't hear it, but BitNickel.
Term.
Yeah. Well, if it is, I've copyrighted it. So
no, you haven't.
Send me a bit nickel if you use bit nickel.
Yeah,
I couldn't have. I've never thought of anything cool in my life, so it couldn't have been me.
I do, but all day, every day. That's what
I
do.
I know that. Yeah. But you work at it. If I get a good one, it will fall out, and someone else will need to recognize it. But which you did, thank you.
I think you did invent this. I termed it. I searched it on Google in quotes, and the only thing that comes up is things like "I felt a bit nickel and dimed by him" or something. So the thing I was going to say, though, this is kind of interesting. I ran across this thing. Satoshi, the inventor of Bitcoin, said he addressed people losing Bitcoin because he knew it was going to happen. And he said it's not a bad thing because an unspent Bitcoin slightly increases the value of everyone else's Bitcoin. It's a contribution to the community. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's a deflation of the money supply.
Thank you for your service to the Bitcoin community by losing that bit nickel.
I was proud to do my part by being an irresponsible owner of a bit nickel.
You know, the same could be said when government sees, you know, thousands of Bitcoin from people. I mean, it's horrible for the person it happens to, but it probably helps the overall value of everyone's Bitcoin. And I think that they imagine when they seize it and are very public about it that they're going to drive the price down because people are going to go, oh no, the FBI seized a bunch of it. But you know, one thing too is like they seize it by like stealing someone's computer or having password capture software on their computer. They haven't cracked Bitcoin yet. They haven't figured out how.
If the Fed worked in reverse, you know, they would announce that today the Fed erased 45 billion Bitcoins and that everybody's value went up. It's great.
Because they wouldn't be able to sell them either because no one would buy them. And, you know, you could trace where they go by looking at the blockchain. You know, who's going to do business with – I mean, there are probably, you know, people like the Winklevoss brothers who might. But, you know, nobody would do business with them who's a cool Bitcoin person. Although if Cody Wilson's dark wallet works, maybe one of the biggest uses of it will be the FBI washing their stolen money so they can sell it clandestinely.
You know that I just accidentally – gave the government the plan for the destruction of Bitcoin. They have to do is buy them and lose them, just like I did, and it's over.
Or, you know, what they could really do, this is what Andreas Andropoulos, I can't pronounce his name, said, you know, that they've got this, somebody said, well, what if they took that huge supercomputer cluster in Utah, the NSA has, and, you know, turned it for a couple days to try to, you know, pollute the Bitcoin blockchain to try to do something like a small 51% attack. And he said it would be like the biggest Keystone Cop blunder in the world. They could work, you know, for a week and spend billions of dollars. And then, you know, the Bitcoin miners would all agree to reject that block or that set of blocks and quash it, where the government could realize that instead they could just take that computing power and mine Bitcoin and actually make some money.
How many Bitcoins are left to mine, right?
Some millions. So I think we're not going to get around to talking about how square it is that Wyoming and Nebraska are trying to charge Colorado for being a marijuana state. It's like, you should pay for our policing because we're square because we think we need to do more policing because there's drugs.
They'll figure something out.
Well, thanks, Randy. It's been another good show with you. I've had fun, man.
Hey, same here, Michael. Have a good night.
Worms.
This has been Michael Dean After Dark. I hope we've helped calm the hamster in your brain and left you in a better place than where we found you. We'll be here 5 nights a week, same time and channel. In the meantime, go to michaelwdean.com for more. That's michaelwdean.com. Thank you and have a wonderful evening. Good night.